Iku Iluna, please rise.
Aohea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha. Ho o kolo kolo ki e ke e hanohano. O ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoi mai, e malio mai, i lohi i e kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Inoho i lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCPW-22-078. William M. Hicks et al. Versus the 2021 Hawaii Reapportionment Commission et al. Arguing for the petitioner, Mateo Caballero. Arguing for the respondent, Lauren Chun, Deputy Attorney General. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. The court's excited to return to in-person oral arguments today, although we are also streaming our proceeding live on the judiciary's YouTube channel. Counsel, just to confirm the breakdown of time for today, each side has 30 minutes. Mr. Caballero, 15 minutes. We'll warn you at 15 minutes in, and you've reserved 15 minutes for rebuttal, correct? Ms. Chun, we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go, correct? Very well. Please proceed, Mr. Caballero.
Good afternoon. My name is Mateo Caballero, and I represent petitioners in this matter. Some of petitioners are here with us in the courtroom today. Thank you. And I appreciate the court's effort to hear this matter so quickly. Because representation is fundamental to democracy, the Hawaii Constitution and laws contemplate that reapportionment must be objective and impartial. To fulfill that purpose, they provide detailed criteria that seek to avoid gerrymandering, unfairness, and favoritism. The 2021 final legislative reapportionment plan shamelessly violates those criteria for no legitimate reason. Additionally, the Reapportionment Commission unconstitutionally delegated its redistricting powers to a secret group of four commissioners who drew the final plan in a proverbial smoke-filled backroom. This is neither the fair process nor the impartial plan that the Hawaii Constitution contemplates. Petitioners offer three reasons for invalidating the final legislative plan and its publication, as well as directing the commission to draw new maps. First, the final legislative reapportionment plan violates Article 4, Section 6 of the Hawaii Constitution by not wholly including 35 out of 51 representative districts within a senatorial district, even though it was entirely possible to do so. The commission didn't even bother to explain any of those 35 deviations, and the limited explanations provided were problematic and not based on the Constitution. Second, the final plan violates Hawaii Revised Statute Section 25-2B5 by not wholly including 9 legislative districts within our congressional districts, even though, again, it was wholly possible to do so, perhaps for all except one district. Finally, the commission improperly delegated its redistricting power under the Constitution to a group of four commissioners who not only operated in secret, but also failed to explain their process, findings, and failure to follow the district within district requirements to the rest of the commission, the public, and this court. I will now proceed to discuss each one of those points in turn, focusing on the first and the third.
Mr. Caballero, as you start with that first point, what is the standard of review? What should we defer in any way to the commission's determinations, or should we be looking at this wholly anew?
Sure. So you should be looking at it wholly anew. And the reason for that is, let me first address the mandamus review standard that they cited in the response, with the clear and undisputable right. Article 4, Section 10 confers this court jurisdiction not only to grant mandamus, but also, and I quote, to correct any error made in a reapportionment plan or to take such other action to effectuate the purpose of this section, which if you read the constitutional papers, it says is to effectuate the purpose of the reapportionment provisions contained in the Constitution. So this court has broad powers. This is not a typical mandamus petition, and the clear and undisputable right standard doesn't apply. In terms of what is the standard of review here, this is an original matter before the court. And for that reason, you know, as the court stated in Kawamoto, the court, there is no typical standard of review. Instead, the court just has to interpret the Constitution and apply whatever is the legal standard in the Constitution to what happened here.
But in Kawamoto, didn't we go on and say that there was an area or an issue in that case where there was sort of a judgment call, and we would want to at least initially give some deference to the commission's findings? They're a county level.
Well, this is not at the county level. This is happening at the state level. And again, Article 4, Section 10 applies, which wouldn't apply in Kawamoto. So I do think that the discretion of this court is broader here than it was there. But more importantly, in terms of determining whether there was an error in how they applied those standards, you know, that's a legal question that this court can review de novo. Whether the explanation provided later on is one that, you know, they had the discretion to make, perhaps that's where you can confer some level of discretion to.
Excuse me, Ms. Caballero, if we accept your argument that Article 4, Section 6 is a mandatory requirement, that means the commission must give it particular effect, which is what you're arguing, right? Then how are we supposed to evaluate the commission's determination whether it would be practicable to put districts within districts? I mean, wouldn't we have to use the abuse of discretion standard?
So let me break down question in two. First, as the constitutional history makes clear, there are 8 criteria under the Constitution. 4 of them are strictly mandatory, and they must follow it, both in intent and effect,
I understand
no matter
that
what.
You want us to give mandatory effect, though, to subsection 6, right?
I do.
So?
And so for the remaining 4 that either say were practicable, were possible, the history is very clear. There is no ranking. Instead, what they're supposed to do is try to fulfill them. And if they can't, they have to provide some sort of explanation grounded on the other criteria in the Constitution. And that would be the standard here. It was entirely practicable. It was possible to draw maps where all 51 of the House districts would be within a Senate district.
My question is, wouldn't we have to use the abuse of discretion standard? Because otherwise, it would seem that we are substituting our own judgment for the commission's.
Well, it can apply some level of deference as to the explanation given. But here they provided no explanation. The explanations they have provided are not grounded on the Constitution, and they didn't really follow any regular process. As the second point that I made.
Is your argument that there's an abuse of discretion because there was no justification?
Well, there was no justification, and we meet, by the way, the abuse of discretion standard here. So, you know, I don't think the court has to even decide the issue, because whatever standard it is, I think abuse of discretion would be the most deferential standard that would apply. And we clearly meet it, because it's 35 out of 51 House districts that were not within a Senate district, and the explanations are not grounded in the Constitution and don't make sense.
Based on
that record.
It's a little hard for you to kind of have to wander around for each question. I can see that, but I'm over here. So let me ask your help on applying the standard, because it's concerning that I guess only 31% of the House districts ended up in one Senate district. But why is that significant? What percentage are you looking for? Is it a percentage, or are you just concerned because there wasn't an adequate explanation about why 69% of the House districts didn't end up in a Senate district?
Sure. I think it's both. In terms of the sheer numbers, not every year, not every cycle, you're able to, it's practicable to include House districts within Senate districts. Just go back to the 2011 cycle. And because you had an odd number of house districts, both here on Oahu and on the island of Hawaii, it was simply not practicable to neatly fit two into one Senate district. This cycle, it is entirely practical. And there is, we submit, there is no trade-off. No, if you build the plans like Petitioner Hicks did, and you begin by drawing your house districts and you follow all seven criteria, and then by the end, you just put two house districts together and form the Senate districts, there is really no trade-off between the district within district requirement and the remaining seven criteria.
Well, help me with this, because I know from Mr. Hicks's point of view, there's no difficulty complying, right? Because you can put all the House districts into a Senate district, a single district. But that, of course, isn't the requirement of the Constitution, right? The where practicable is a standard that applies here. And I think Mr. Nonaka, for example, cited a couple of reasons why he felt that perhaps it would be difficult because you are changing the legacy of different districts, changing, I guess, the history of voting in the districts. So if you wouldn't mind helping in terms of the substance, what is the specific reason why you think it wasn't practicable? Understanding that we don't have to necessarily have all the districts, right? You can see that all the congressional districts don't necessarily have to be in a Senate district.
Well, here, you know, in general, it was possible. So they should strive to do it. If they couldn't, they should provide an explanation.
Okay,
like,
so
specific district,
yeah.
Let's say, you know, for X or Y reason, grounded on the Constitution, we're not following the standard, and therefore it, you know, crosses the Senate line.
Mr. Caballero, can you point to anything in the record aside from the plan itself that suggests the commission ignored the district within district requirement?
Well, they for one, they didn't provide an explanation. First of all, even
is,
when they
is not providing an explanation, ignoring that guideline.
Well, let me point a specific point in the record, which is last cycle around, Maui had all house districts within Senate districts, within the Senate districts. And when they first presented the plan to the entire commission, they didn't even mention that this cycle, they were going to change that. And none of the commissioners asked the question as to why are we not following the district within district requirement. There was a 3-minute explanation about the map. And no one, you know, there was no explanation whatsoever about why, even though last time Maui fit all house districts within Senate districts, this time it had to be changed.
Let me ask you this. I mean, there was, one more question.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
There, you know, there was a considerable amount of discussion, at least, that holistically the commission considered all the criteria. How would you respond to that being sufficient justification?
Well, that would essentially make it so that all they have to do is provide, you know, pay lip service to the Constitution, say we considered everything, and then proceed to ignore them. But, you know, the constitutional criteria are meant to be followed, not ignored. And here they ignore them, and the record is devoid of any explanation why they were ignored. And I actually have another very good example in the record as to how they ignored it. And is they now claim there are only 33 districts that are not wholly within Senate districts, because in fact, the technical staff fixed two just by moving lines a little bit, you know, 200 people here, 200 people there. If they were in fact, you know, if they cared about this requirement, they would have done that long ago. They had months to do it. Instead, they left it to the technical staff, and clearly they didn't care to follow it enough that for those two districts where it was easy to do, they just didn't do it.
Mr. Caballero, I want to go back to the, over here, to the standard of care, the standard of review. Your first prayer for relief is for declaratory judgment.
Yes.
And the subsequent ones, you're assuming that we're going to grant declaratory judgment, and therefore you're asking for mandamus relief. But for declaratory judgment, we have to declare as a matter of law that the reapportionment plan is invalid. Is that what you're asking us to do?
Yes, that is correct.
Oh, and this is despite, how do we get to as a matter of law that it's invalid when the commission, the criteria, a lot of the criteria are not mandatory. It should do these things if practicable. How do you get from this discretionary ability of the reapportionment commission to jump to as a matter of law, they didn't comply with it?
Well, the way we suggest this court should interpret where practicable is that it should be done if it's possible. And if and the only justification...
Is that what the definition of practicable is, if
it
possible?
It is. Generally, the dictionary definition of practicable is that. And even if it's ambiguous in any way, you can go to the Constitutional Convention papers. And what it says is that, yes, the commission has some discretion as to how to weigh those criteria where it says where practicable. But they're supposed to weigh those criteria, not base it on, you know, completely extraneous preferences and reasons. And in this situation, we have very clear concerns that they were not basing it on the Constitution. They were not trying to weigh the 8 criteria and make decisions as to how to do that. Instead, they were doing it because they had concerns about, you know, legacy maps about, you know, what would happen to incumbents.
If they meant possible, why did they say practicable?
Well, they use both. They use where practicable and possible, depending on which standard. They use both, right, in the Constitution.
So they're not interchangeable. They're used in different places.
They are used in different places, but the history, the constitutional history says that in fact, they're using it essentially interchangeable. They say, we don't mean to rank them in any way. Even though some say we're possible, even though some say we're practicable, you know, they should strive to follow all of them. And the balance between those four, if there are trade-offs that need to be made, yes, that is within the commission's discretion. But here we have proven that there are no trade-offs.
What do you mean? I especially looking at like Mr. Nonaka's affidavit, mm-hmm, and Ms. Ono's affidavit, where they talk about, for instance, the proposed plan for the Big Island. Well, sure, that would keep those people together, but then the people in the Northwest would be joined to the people in the East, and they're completely different. So, I don't exactly know what you mean.
So what I mean of trade-offs, and I understand that the plan for the Big Island is a little bit different, because you have to draw that line. Even though Mr. Boye started with the Senate maps, and then he drew the line to roughly divide each district in half, so that you would, in population-wise, so that you would have house districts of equal population. You know, he was making that line, and the commission is just agreeing essentially in those declarations, disagreeing with how that line was drawn. However, if you look at the Hicks plan, it begins with the house districts drawn by the commission, and no declaration, the response, they don't even address the Hicks plan. They start with the house districts for Oahu drawn by the commission itself, which presumably already weighted all these factors.
Okay, here's my next.
And then they put two house districts together to form a Senate district. Therefore, there is no trade-off between the district within district requirement and the remaining 7.
I assume that your argument is that they should have considered the Hicks plan.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. Your argument is that they should have considered the Hicks plan. Is that one of your arguments?
Well, what the Hicks plan shows is that it was practicable. That here there was very little trade-off. There was no trade-off between the district within district requirement and the remaining 7. And that the explanations... that they kept saying that they had considered all these criteria, is just not credible, because again, it was doable. Yet they just, it is as if they drew entirely different maps.
Mr. Caballero, on the Big Island, so we're going a little bit over, but I think, you have some questions that I think we want to get answered, at least to this part. The Big Island, the methodology, is it Mr. Boye?
Yeah.
That he proposes is different from Mr. Hicks. In other words, Mr. Hicks says, take the two house districts, combine them. And on the Big Island, it's the opposite. Now, so it seems to me, the methodology is different. Is there something that's so, if it's so mathematically precise, why do we have such different methodologies on two different islands? In other words, if your point is this is so clear, so obvious, yet the methodology, the clear, obvious methodology is not being applied on the Big Island. At least that's my question. Perhaps it is. And if so, clear it up for me.
So there are different methodologies. And I'll concede that the Boye plan, people might disagree as to where those lines are drawn, because they were not drawn by the commission. And therefore, you know, I do think there is discretion in terms of how the commission draws those lines, and they can disagree and they provide reasons why. However, in the Hicks plan, we're starting with the smallest type of district here, which is the House district, and those were drawn by the commission. And presumably they made all those, you know, they, if they had to weigh all the different considerations, they did. And then all they had to do to follow the constitution was to put two House districts together and have a Senate district.
At this point, I have two questions. Sure. Are your clients at this point conceding, you're not arguing the way the House districts were drawn at this point, is that correct? You're just saying that two contiguous House districts should have been combined to form one senatorial district.
That's correct. All right.
The other question I have is with respect to your second issue. It seems that both sides here are conceding that Chapter 92 applies here. And my question is that question actually that clear? The Constitution says the commission shall act by a majority vote of its membership and shall establish its own procedures except as provided by law. So clearly, by law is by statute, and by the face of Chapter 92, at first blush, it appears that it would apply to this Constitution Commission. But it says by law, and HRS 25, Section 3, the legislature says all hearings and proceedings shall be governed by this chapter for reapportionment and by rules of practice and procedure established by the commission. Now, this language that all hearings and proceedings shall be governed by this chapter and by rules of practice and procedure established by appears nowhere else in the Hawaii Revised Statutes from my legal research. And there's many statutes in which the HRS says shall by rules established pursuant to Chapter 91, right? If Chapter 92, the Sunshine Law, applies here, then why wouldn't Chapter 91 also apply? Now, because by definition, it would also apply Chapter 91, the rulemaking procedures, the Hawaii Administrative Procedure Act, that has all of these requirements, earns notice, and very, very difficult to establish and change rules. And I'm wondering whether the legislature, because the Constitution allows the legislature to establish procedures by law, they have language in the reapportionment chapter saying, hey, you're going to conduct in your hearings and pursuant to this chapter. And in that chapter, they set out like certain hearing requirements. They have one 20-day notice requirement. So they set out specific things with respect to the reapportionment commission. But I'm wondering whether the legislature actually intended for Chapter 91 and 92 to apply based on this language. And the other question is based on is there an argument to be made that pursuant to 92-6, though under the Sunshine Law, which excludes the judicial branch and adjudicatory functions of boards and commissions, whether this is an adjudication type of function. It's different. It's not a contested case hearing. I recognize that. But you're asking this commission to make a decision based on discretion and judgment. And I believe that at least Missouri has clearly held that the Sunshine Law does not apply to reapportionment commission. So I'm just wondering whether you believe, please respond to my concerns as to whether or not 92 and 91 were actually intended to apply to this commission.
Sure. In terms of 92, we believe it applies. They seem to concede that it applies. They claim it didn't. And I would call the court's attention to the OIP opinion that they cite, 06-02, which essentially says you cannot have a standing committee that presents something to the board and then, you know, after the presentation kind of continues and comes back and presents something else. Instead, it says they have to be, you know, clear findings, they have to explain those findings. And once there is a final report, it's over. The pig has to end. And that didn't happen here. They presented the initial plan on October 14th, and then they kept coming back with new plans, even though it was the same pig.
So you are arguing that the Reapportionment Commission must prepare findings of fact and conclusions of law. Is that right?
We believe it is required by the Constitution. If this court under Article 4, Section 10 is to review the plans for gerrymandering, fairness, impartiality, objectivity, there has to be some sort of process for this court to make those determinations, a process they just don't provide you right now.
In our past, are you aware whether or not in our past election content, in the reapportionment challenges to reapportionment, whether there have been findings or conclusions that this court has reviewed? I don't recall seeing them.
I don't recall. What I can say is that how this commission operated is particularly secretive when compared to, for example, even some of the council, the county commissions, which actually draw the lines openly. They don't create a pig and then have them do all these decisions and then come back and present the plans. Some of the commissions actually are able to just have an open process.
Justice Wilson.
Thank you.
We'll give you some time to respond. So don't worry, at the end, there'll be some rebuttal time.
I'll try to make it just a short question. You mentioned gerrymandering. So could you explain what evidence you think there is of gerrymandering, if any, in this case?
Well, the Constitution doesn't necessarily require evidence of gerrymandering. What we have is evidence that, you know, 68% of the time, they didn't follow one of those criteria, which is a pretty large number. For purposes of population-based deviations, this court has adopted a 10% safe harbor. Here we have a 68% difference that, again, they didn't even try to address or explain for any given district.
I thought the response said they complied 80% of the time.
Excuse me?
I thought the response said they complied 80% of the time.
No, they for the House, for the constitutional requirement, they only complied 35% of the time, they claim now, and they conceded. There's no question that it was only 35% of the time based on those two districts they fixed.
So Caballero, just to wrap up before we get to Ms. Chen, what exactly do you want us to order with regard to Oahu? What do you want us to tell the commission to do? What is the relief you seek?
The relief we seek is that the court invalidates the plan and then tells the commission to, you know, essentially draw new maps that follow all the criteria. And if they are not going to, if they decide again to violate one of the criteria, that they provide an explanation for this court to review whether in fact the criteria was followed or not, or whether the court decides it's abuse of discretion, whether they abuse the discretion by doing so. And that they, if Sunshine applies, that then they, instead of having this standing committee that draws all the plans in secret, that they actually follow Sunshine.
So just to be clear, you're not asking that we direct them to adopt the Hicks plan. You're asking us to tell them to go back and do it again, consistent with whatever directives you think we should give to them. Correct?
That's correct.
And can we get that done by election day?
Well, this court, in my opinion, already decided that question when back in July, both the commission and the state were before the court and they asked for extension of deadlines. And at the end of that order, it says that the remaining of the constitutional and statutory provisions would continue to apply as normal. And we actually filed this petition before the February 28th deadline that this court set in that case.
You think that we can do this without, and I was very imprecise of the way I worded my question, without disrupting the scheduled election dates? You believe there is enough time to get it done?
Yes, they did it. In January, they received new extraction numbers for the military, and they were able to draw plans within a few weeks.
All right, very well. Thank you. And now we'll hear from Ms. Chen.
John.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. The petitioner's counsel started his argument today by saying that his clients are here to protect the democratic process. But what they're asking you to do is to substitute the judgment of a bipartisan, bicamerally appointed body, which was created by the Constitution and vested with the discretion to create redistricting plans for the state, and substitute it with the judgment of the petitioners themselves. Now, in this case, the petitioners are asking for an extraordinary relief. They want a writ of mandamus, but not because they have evidence that the final maps that the commission drew do not achieve the goal of voter equality, but simply because they disagree with how the commission applied one of the constitutional criteria, the district within a district guideline. Now, there are three reasons why the petitioners cannot satisfy their burden to prove that they're entitled to a writ of mandamus here.
Ms. Chun, can you address the request for declaratory judgment first? Because you don't get to the mandamus until you get past the declaratory judgment.
Sure, Your Honor. So as I heard counsel explain, they want a declaratory judgment that the plans that were produced were unconstitutional as a matter of law. And we argue that to even get there, it's not just a question of law, it's also a question as to whether the commission abused their discretion when they came up with those plans. So in that sense, since Your Honor asked the question, I will address the abuse of discretion standard.
Actually, let me ask you this then, sure. Because in terms of the standard of review, is the issue of whether or not including state legislative districts within Senate districts practicable, is that a question of law, or is that a purely a question of fact or discretion, or is a mixed question of fact and law, which would then be reviewed de novo as to whether or not it is practicable?
So if I could address one of, I think, an underlying assumption of that question, which is why do we need to decide whether it is practicable to keep districts wholly within other districts?
Because the Constitution says that the commission shall be guided by that criteria as well as others. And it appears that it's unclear to me whether the commission was guided by that criterion.
Yes. So, Your Honor, I think our interpretation, I'll try to see if I can answer your question with this. Our interpretation, and I think as Justice Edens echoed during petitioner's argument, is that the Constitution doesn't mandate that those criteria be given any specific effect in the eventual maps that are drawn, except for the
I agree. Criteria. It does require that the reapportionment commission be guided by those criteria.
Yes.
And it's unclear to me whether the commission was guided by that criteria.
Sure. So
because I see in the affidavits discussions about, you know, we tried to keep the districts the way they were to the extent possible. And we heard from people in the community as to their concerns, and of course, the Constitution requires that community input be provided, but I was wondering whether the community input was more along the lines of what is supposed to be the criterion, such as, you know, socioeconomic status, making sure that we're not including rural, just combining urban and rural, or whether they're following clear features, the criteria that are actually within the Constitution.
Right. So to address the question as to whether they were guided by the district within district criteria, We cited to evidence in the record where the individual commissioners said, I think it's on pages 14 to 17 of our brief, where they said in open meetings that they considered all of the criteria, including the district within district criteria, and they didn't find it practicable to follow at that time. Now, the Constitution, in addition to not mandating...
Why? I'm a little bit confused. Why was it impracticable to do so? What I don't understand is it seems to me that it's pretty clear that if you had, like in Kauai, if you have three House districts and one Senate district, it might be a little bit difficult. It might be practicable. But it seems to me that if you have 34 and 17 and 8 and 4 and 6 and 3, I'm having difficulty understanding why it's not practicable to just take the two House and then combine two House and form a Senate.
So my overarching answer to that question is that it could still be practicable, but the commission has the discretion not to.
Right. So what other guiding concerns prohibited it?
I don't know if anything prohibited it, but they have, again, the decision whether to give it any effect is something that is squarely within their decision.
You're arguing that the commission doesn't have to consider it?
I'm saying that they do have to consider it, and we do have record evidence saying that they did consider it.
I just wanted to follow up on Justice McKenna's question, because you've said a couple times that they said they considered it, but you could agree that that's not an adequate explanation. If there's some need for the commission to comply with a legal standard, whether it's abuse of discretion or not, they have to do more than say we complied, right? They have to actually provide evidence. And in this case, my understanding is that the evidence that was referred to had to do with the idea of not changing what is a legacy of previous voting habits, or it might be, as the chair said at one point, this would just be so disruptive if we were to change the Senate districts. So both of those explanations were offered. If there's more than that, I'd be very interested in it, because those explanations don't seem to, as Justice McKenna suggested, it's necessary to look at the criteria. And this criteria isn't exactly just advisory, right? Because it has mandatory language. It's sort of a hybrid. It says, where practicable, representative districts shall be wholly included. So wouldn't you agree that once there's a determination it's practicable, then they shall comply with Section 6? And assuming that we're in agreement on that, can you tell me what evidence there is that they did actually apply a factual analysis that suggested it wasn't practicable?
Sure. Well, I actually respectfully disagree with that interpretation of the guideline. I don't think that it mandates that if the commission finds it practicable, that it must then keep districts wholly within other districts. And the reason for that I say that is because...
wouldn't that mean that this sentence that says, where practicable, representative districts shall be wholly included within senatorial districts, would be amended to say, where practicable, representative districts may be wholly included? I mean, wouldn't you be looking for different language than shall?
I think that's, that could accomplish the same goal. But I think the prefatory language at the beginning of the section where it says that the commission shall be guided by these things, I think that indicates that it's, again, a consideration and not a mandate to act. And then to answer the question as to why I also think that's not what the framers of the Constitution intended, I would say to the 1968 Standing Committee reports, which we attached as Appendix A, where the commission clearly says that this guideline, specifically the district within a district guideline, is not intended to be an absolute restriction. They did not intend it to be mandatory.
I agree with you. Mm-hmm. It's not completely mandatory if it turns out that it's not practicable. Right. But I guess the issue we were coming down to was the facts. I mean, what showed that it wasn't practicable? you maybe are implying that it was practicable, and then but there must be some facts that say that even though it's practicable, they couldn't do it, and they really deviated from this in a way that's pretty significant, right? Because we're talking about 35 out of 51. It's like 69% of the congressional districts were not within a Senate district. So what was the justification for that?
So I think the petitioner's maps indicate that it's possible to have two House districts within each Senate district. But we have to remember that didn't become numerically possible until very late in the redistricting process. That only became possible, I believe it was the beginning of January, where after the commission received new military numbers on New Year's Eve, they realized they had to move one House district from Oahu over to the Big Island.
Now, but that's an interesting interpretation, because wasn't that after Mr. Hicks showed that you could do it in his map?
No, because the Hicks map presupposes that there are going to be 17 Senate districts and 34 House districts. So it was not numerically possible before those new numbers came out.
Right. So after those new numbers came out, then why wasn't just two contiguous House? Why didn't they just combine two and create one Senate district? That's where I'm having a problem. Right. I understand. There will be times when you don't have, like on Oahu, because you're not supposed to have canoe districts, you could have 33 House seats and 17 senators. And then how do you do it? I mean, I understand that. But when you have this equal number, why didn't they just do that at that point?
Sure. Oh, well, again, I think the map, the petitioner's map show it's possible. I think, again, standard of review has to be abuse of discretion. And I think we have to say that the commission did not abuse its discretion when it decided not to do that. And I'll tell you the reason why, one of the reasons at least that, would be a basis for making that decision is because those maps, the Senate and the House district maps, had already gone through the entire public hearing process. They had already been subject to intense public scrutiny and public comment. And at that point, the new numbers showed that all that had to, the only numbers that had to change was the number of House districts on Oahu and the number of House districts on the Big Island. So it was practicable and an entirely reasonable exercise of discretion for the commission to decide, if it didn't have to change the Senate maps based on that new numbers, to keep it the same as what the public had already seen and commented on, and then to only make changes where needed to those House districts. I think the court would have to agree that that is a reasonable exercise of discretion and a decision that should be, it's really a policy decision that should be vested within the commission itself.
But doesn't the Constitution allow for challenges and then for the commission to continue its services based on challenges to finalize, which does not require additional notices and hearings? I mean, are you saying that if this court were to grant some relief as requested by the petitioner here, you would have to restart the entire process with public hearings?
I don't think that we'd have to restart the entire process. I'm saying that there's a reasonable explanation for why the commission didn't change the Senate maps and only changed the House district maps when it had to. If you're asking about what effect the petitioner's requested relief would have, truthfully, I don't know. I don't know how long it would take the commissioners to come up with new maps. As I think their declarations show, every time you change one of the lines, there's kind of a domino effect on the rest of the island, and they have to reevaluate to see whether the criteria is still being met, whether they're satisfied that this is a good map.
Thank you so much. You've responded to my question, okay, but I want to get back to the explanation then.
Sure.
The commission seems to be conceding that 92 applies, though the Sunshine Law, but you argue that it was complied with. Is it the commission's position that the Sunshine Law does apply to its proceedings?
I don't think we did that analysis. I think we've always acted with the assumption that it does apply.
Okay. So let me ask you this. If 92 applies, then why doesn't 91? Because it applies to agencies also. That's the Administrative Procedure Act that requires rulemaking procedures, all the notice, and, as indicated, findings of fact, conclusions of law. Why would that not apply also here then?
I don't think that would apply. I don't think we've interpreted 91 to apply, and I don't have the analysis for that, so I can't answer that question more completely. I'm sorry, but
if 92 applies, then if there was a violation, do we even have jurisdiction? The statute says you have to go to circuit court to challenge a 92 violation. So that's another reason I wonder why, whether the legislature actually intended for 92 to apply here, because what if they had chosen to challenge the first meeting where it appears that Mr. Nonaka had spoken to at least several commissioners in advance of the hearing. It's unclear whether he had spoken to more than three to decide who the chair should be. I mean, what if they had challenged that right away? They would have gone to circuit court, challenged that, and then the reapportionment commission could have been stuck in circuit court for a while. I mean, that seems to be what you are conceding here when you are conceding that 92, if you concede that 92 applies here.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
So that's what I'm wondering. Mm-hmm. If 92 applies, if there's a violation, anyone can go to circuit court to challenge it. That takes a while.
It does.
And this is a tight frame commission. In the most ideal world, that has basically about 10 months, right, to make a decision every 10 years. I mean, they're appointed, you know, they have to do so much stuff within 10 months. And this time they only had, they had very little time to do it, you know. Sorry.
Ms. Chun, I want to come back to the reasoning given by the commission for rejecting Mr. Hicks's plan. I think the petitioners argue that it was a matter of time. We don't have enough time to change this at this point in the process, but what is your understanding of what the actual explanation is that's reflected in the record is for why the Hicks plan was not adopted, at least in part?
Your Honor, I can't say what the commission's...
I don't want to know what's in their heads. I want to know what's
right,
in the record.
Right. Well, in citing to the record, I think it's... The surrounding circumstances that I just talked about, the fact that, they have maps that had already gone through the process. If the intent is to maximize public input, the public had already commented on those specific maps. I think it was just, if the court is looking to this record, they have to be satisfied that it was an abuse of discretion on this record.
So it's timing. That's what Mr. Caballero argues is,
right.
Hey, they said it was too late. This didn't come up until we really couldn't rerun the process and meet the deadlines. Is that what you understand the proffered explanation was? Because there's discussions of people having preferences for existing or starting with existing boundaries, starting with that as a starting point, but.
Right.
When you get to the bottom line, is it timing or are those other factors, were they proffered reasons? And if so, were they legit?
I think timing is a big part of it. I think the other reasons, I think that, again, the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances here. So in terms of, I think there was a stated preference for keeping existing district lines. And I think the commission the constitution itself kind of indicates a preference for keeping existing lines. It says that the commission shall redraw lines as necessary. They've heard from people who just didn't want to have their lines changed very much. And I think, just as a, I think what the petitioners are arguing in part is an abuse of discretion, is a failure to adopt the methodology that they want, which is to draw the House districts first and then to encircle them with Senate districts. But again, the methodology is something that's left to the discretion of the commission. And there's reasons not to necessarily have Senate districts based entirely on House districts. I mean,
are those reasons given in the record? In other words, I'm not seeing something like, well, if we do it Mr. Hicks's way, you're going to be dividing X community in half. And that's terrible because, you know, these folks should all be in one Senate district. Those kinds right. of explanations there? I mean, because that would be sort of a something we could get our hands around, evaluate, mm-hmm. as opposed to a general, yeah, we thought about that, but, you know, there just wasn't enough time.
No, I don't think that there is much in the record to that effect, besides what we've cited in our briefs. But again, with the abuse of discretion standard, I think the court has to, you know, be able to say that there's no reasonable way or no, you know, justifiable reason that the commission could have done it this way.
Ms. Chun, you know, earlier you were talking about alleged history in connection with your arguments about abuse of discretion. I think you were probably getting to the fact that the alleged history suggests that there should be balancing among the non-mandatory Article 4, Section 6 factors. That would be 1 through 3 and subsection 7. Now, in connection with your argument about discretion, is it your position that the commission has the discretion to consider factors other than those giving effect to Article 4, Section 6 guidelines? In other words, would it be an abuse of discretion for the commission to give preference to plans that preserve core legacy historic districts over others other plans that don't?
No, I don't think that would be an abuse of discretion. I think that I can't say that anything that's not included in those guidelines is proper.
Well, let me ask you this. The Voting Rights Act isn't in there, and if it was not practicable to comply with the Voting Rights Act, that would be something that would invalidate the plan, right? And that's not in the criteria, right. Is it?
Certainly.
Continue. So is there some discretion? Now, it's not mandatory. They don't have to consider it. But can the commission consider historic districts?
I think so, yes.
And what's your basis for that?
Well, I think part of it is in terms of having a commission that is responsive to public input, the commission needs to, even though, again, public input, for example, isn't one of the criteria, the commission has to have public hearings and has to listen to people. So I think, that is a reasonable preference if the commission in their discretion sees fit to keep historical communities together. I think that's a valid.
And in fact, the Supreme Court of the United States in the Carter decision in 1983 basically said that it's not unconstitutional for a reapportionment commission to consider things like incumbency and historic districts when they are formulating a plan. So if that was considered, it would comply with the Constitution, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Thank you.
But under our Constitution, and I agree with you, it says the commission shall redraw district lines where necessary for in terms of, the population and et cetera. But under our Constitution, it does say that no district shall be drawn as to unduly favor a person. That's one of the criteria under our Constitution.
And that's a good question. If I can follow up on that. Now, would you consider, if we're considering a historic district, would that be an incumbent? Would you equate a historic or legacy district with incumbency? And then would you consider incumbency a person that would not comply with, I think that's subsection 3, where you can't unduly favor a person or political faction?
No, not necessarily. And I think that's, partly because we don't have any evidence that keeping a historic district together is going to unduly benefit an incumbent to the, I guess, to the disadvantage of anyone else in particular.
And are all these criteria in Article 4, Section 6, aren't they really truly governed to ensure compliance with, well, one person, one vote?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I'll also point out that I don't think that the framers of the Constitution intended this specific district within a district guideline to be a priority for its own sake.
Could I, since you've repeatedly referred to the need for preserving historic districts as a reason perhaps for this degree of variation from the Provision 6, what historic districts? I mean, we're talking about approximately 35 House districts. How many of them were included or not included in the Senate district because it's preserving a historic district? And how was that defined in the record? If we're going to deviate from this constitutional provision, okay, what are the historic areas that were being protected?
Understood. And I think I have to clarify, I'm not saying that that was a reason for the deviation. I'm saying it's something that the commission could consider and wouldn't be a violation of the Constitution. But as to, you know, the record, I don't think that there's no, you know, constitutional or statutory requirement that the commission provide a reason for why it draws each and every line. I mean, I just want to quickly go to some of the language in the committee's report, where it tells us, it tells us basically that these guidelines, these factors are incredibly complex, they're inextricably entwined, and that using them to create workable districts is extremely difficult. And for all those reasons, the report vests discretion for how to best do that with the commission itself.
Ms. Chen, I'm really confused in your, and I generally am asking you to explain that. You say in your brief that the final reapportionment plan results in a whopping 88% of legislative districts being wholly included. And I know Mr. Caballero has come up with a different 38% compliance. So I think obviously I'm missing something on, you guys are measuring different things.
Sure. So that 88% number is the amount of state legislative districts that are wholly within either Congressional District 1 or Congressional District 2. The numbers cited by the petitioner, they say 35 after the commission staff went through the maps and did some final tweaking. There are actually only 33 state House districts, which are not wholly within a state Senate district. So there's two sets of districts within districts there.
Okay. You address the practicality of relief in this case, if we were to do what Mr. Caballero asks, which is to send the matter at least as to Oahu and possibly as to the Big Island of Maui as well, back to the commission. Can it complete the process of coming up with plans that would be compliant with an order, I guess, directing a higher level of specificity, perhaps identifying, you know, what factors can or can't be considered, whatever it may be? How long would that take? And is it going to disrupt the ability of the state to timely hold its elections?
Your Honor, I'm not sure how long it would take. I know it could be a while, but it would depend on, I guess, what guidelines the court gives to the commission about what standards it's going to apply. You know, for instance, the petitioners argue that the ratio of districts that are not fully enclosed within other districts is per se unconstitutional. We argued in our brief that's an arbitrary standard. But if you're going to be remanding this to the commission, I think they need to have some kind of concrete standard to go by. You know, not only to make sure that they have maps that comply with the Constitution, but so they can timely do that. And again, just to answer the question about timing, I know that, you know, assuming the maps are drawn, you know, as quickly as possible, it still takes at least a month, I believe, to go through the precincting process. And that's what has to be done before ballots can be sent out. And then
Ms. Chun, what about public hearings? In the Solomon case from 2011, when the plan was invalidated, it went back, they had to redraw it. They actually did a couple public hearings, which, you know, delayed things a little bit. Do you envision public hearings if it's sent back?
Yes, I think we'd have to do at least two, one to present the proposed maps and then one to have deliberation and decide.
And how would that affect the timing, as the CJ asked?
Well, under the, if we're, you know, still going forward under the Sunshine Law, we need at least 6 days of public notice before any meeting.
I didn't hear the last. You need 6 days of public notice before
before any public meeting.
Okay.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Ms. Chun, you can certainly wrap up if you have any final thoughts for the court. I'm going to give Mr. Caballero a bit more time as well. But
all right. I'll just conclude in saying again that the Constitution recognizes that this is a very important and very difficult process that's rife with judgment calls and discretionary decisions. And it entrusts that those decisions to the bicamerally appointed and bipartisan reapportionment commission. The Constitution sets out different criteria that must be considered, but it's clear that the decision about how to weigh those criteria is within the commission's discretion. And there's no dispute here. I think that the commission did consider all those criteria, and there's no evidence produced by the petitioners that the final maps as a whole evidence an abuse of discretion on the part of the commission. So for those reasons, we ask that the court deny the petition today. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Chun. We will prepare for Mr. Caballero's rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Schumer.
Mr. Caballero, a couple of minutes left, but if you need a few more minutes beyond that, you can have them if need be.
Thank you, Your Honor. So counsel for respondents appear to concede that it was possible, practicable here to in fact have joined two House districts to form a Senate district. What they're saying is that the commission has the discretion to just completely ignore what is written in the Constitution because of their own preferences. Preferences that are not in the Constitution, such things as maintaining legacy districts or historic lines or timing. Neither one of those appears in the Constitution, and we submit to this court that those are not valid reasons.
The Constitution does say redraw district lines. So redraw means, it says redraw where necessary to balance the population. So the Constitution does appear to anticipate starting with existing lines and then redrawing them, you know, depending on the population.
I think it depends on how you interpret the word redrawn. For me, it means essentially drawing new lines. I don't think it necessarily means that you start from the old maps. And I think there is a question of whether that unduly favors incumbents. It's a difficult question, I'll concede, but it's not one that—
Does the constitutional history discuss what is meant by not favor a person or political party, what person means there? Does the constitutional history discuss what is meant by person there?
Well, what I imagine it means is
any— No, I'm just asking you, does the record of the constitutional proceedings discuss it?
It does. I don't have it in front of me, so I cannot tell you exactly what it says.
Right. I'll look for it. Thank you.
But it's in the standing committee report, and they discuss each one of the requirements. So it should be there.
Mr. Caballero, doesn't the Constitution have timelines and deadlines? You said that timing is not in the Constitution, but it is.
It is. And I agree that, you know, the Voting Rights Act following the timelines in the Constitution are appropriate reasons. But in this situation, they could have done it. So I want to address the argument they made that because the maps they have drawn before had already gone through hearings, public hearings, they wanted to maintain them. But we're arguing that, you know, they had house maps that had already been drawn. And if they wanted, it would have been, and they had gone through the public comment. And so if they wanted, they could have easily used those house maps to form their Senate maps. It wouldn't have caused any delay whatsoever. And they managed to draw the new maps, you know, in just a few weeks.
They had the initial map, and then they went out for public hearing, and then they drew a whole new map, taking into consideration like the Makapu wraparound. They changed all that, right? After take, and then they had to change it again when they came with the military and the students who shouldn't be included.
That's correct. And in fact, they made significant changes. In terms of if the concern was that these maps hadn't received sufficient public comment, they actually made significant changes to the house map here on Oahu, to the Senate map here on Oahu, to the house map on the island of Hawaii. So I don't think that's a legitimate reason here for just ignoring what is written in the Constitution. And to me, that's ultimately what this case is about. You know, do those eight criteria, the four that are, you know, provide us where possible, where practical, do they mean something? Or, you know, it's within the sole discretion of the commission to make that determination. And I think that if that's the case, then why include all the criteria in the Constitution? And you know, they have to give it at least some effect. Here, they didn't even try. As I said, in 30, and to answer your question as to how many, what percentage it is, you know, they didn't try to follow it in 35 out of 51. They managed to fix two later, so now it's 33 out of 51. That's somewhere between 68% to 65%. Of house districts, they didn't follow the criteria at all.
Can I interrupt for a sec while you are on this issue about the degree of compliance and the effect? You're focusing on a percentage that seems to refer to having too many congressional districts split up, right? But I wanted to give you a chance if this is part of the focus of your argument, and it to some extent has to do with the allegations of the plaintiffs here, but criteria 8 says where practicable submergence of an area in a larger district wherein substantially different socioeconomic interests predominate shall be avoided. And as Justice Nakayama alluded to, there were some concerns about wraparound districts that didn't allow for the representation of interest in the, you know, Hawaiian community or lower socioeconomic community. Is that a part of your argument? Is there some evidence that inappropriate submergence was taking place?
Well, you know, the petitioners mentioned concerns about submergence initially at the beginning of the petition. That's not our main argument. Ultimately, the argument is the district within district requirement. But I will say this about that requirement. This requirement is objective. It can be easily seen from the map itself. You know, this court, there are judicially manageable standards that this court can come up with in terms of trying to determine whether the district was followed or not. That's not the case for all criteria. Some of these criteria, I agree, it's a little more difficult, like the submergence criteria or like the compactness criteria. Some of those are a little more difficult and require some judgment calls. But here you have an objective, judicially manageable district within district requirement. And it was completely ignored, and they didn't really provide an explanation, at least not an explanation grounded on the Constitution.
I just want to clarify, at this point, you are not challenging the final House districts. Is that correct?
Yes, we are not challenging. They can, if they want to use them as the basis to form the Senate.
So all you're saying is two contiguous should then be combined to form a Senate, and then in terms of the Congress.
Well, they could if they wanted. Or the island of Hawaii, start with the Senate district and draw the line somewhere and form new house maps. I think that's within their discretion as well. But we're not,
but they did,
either way, they
didn't, the Big Island, aren't there, didn't the commission come up with six house districts for the Big
they
Island?
They did. So if they want, they can use those. And
why would we follow somebody else's? Why should the state of Hawaii follow one person's preference as to how everything should be redrawn?
We're not submitting that. The commission ultimately would be the ones deciding how to draw those lines.
Okay.
The Big Island would be a judgment call. It would not be a direct application of Mr. Hicks's methodology.
Yes. If they wanted, they could start with the Senate districts and then divide them in half.
Anything further for the court at this time?
I just want to remind this court of the quote we put in front of the petition, which is that it should be voters who choose their representatives, not the other way around. And I think that's the reason why the Hawaii Constitution, you know, put in place very carefully crafted limitations on the reapportionment process. Yes, they have discretion, but it's not unbound discretion. It's not sole discretion. It's limited discretion here. And the question is whether they went beyond those boundaries, and we submit they did. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Caballero. Thank you to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.